Hello and welcome to the podcast of the Load Seats, episode 1217 for Monday, the 28th of July, 2025. I'm your host, Luca, joined today by Bo the History Bro and the special guest and friend of the show, Leo Kirst. Thanks for coming.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking all about how the British state has just no problems with banning free speech. We're then going to be talking about how The Economist fails to understand the hotel protests. Average midwit at The Economist, no doubt.
But they're supposed to be, I mean, they're supposed to be the smartest and the best, and they're supposed to be, like, not bound by the sort of ideological constraints that would maybe, you know, push the Guardian or something in a
right.
particular direction. They're supposed to be, you know, the trusted voice of the...
And yet.
Well, it's really revealing of, you know, how our political class is so removed from the very sort of obvious truths about the whole thing.
Yeah, and then Bo's going to go beast mode and tell you about how little he cares about women's football. So a nice...
Talk about obvious truths.
Yeah.
Watching the game.
So a nice fun segment to round it all off on. So let's begin. As you may have noticed, the British government is the worst form of petty tyranny. Everything that it does is incredibly arbitrary. And we can't forget, of course, that this Labour government that's come in is really only here because the last Tory government imploded.
Yeah.
There was no natural mandate for Labour. There was no hunger for Labour. And yet they've come in and assumed a moral authority, which was totally ungiven to them. And they've done the most radical things from it with it. I mean, I could talk about the abortion issue. I could talk about, obviously, everything to do with free speech, and I will.
Franchise.
Right.
That was a big one. 16, 17.
16-year-olds voting.
Changing the game.
Yeah.
And just announced. Like, no sort of public consultation or anything like that. Just like, yeah, we're doing it. And it's funny how things like that can be done. Things that are going to radically change the electoral makeup of the country. Mm. Whereas things like the Rwanda plan, which, you know, most people were in favour of, and, you know, had to be battered through various different houses and battered around and, you know, put through all these groups. And then finally kiboshed because the Uniparty, the establishment that really runs everything, because the government, you know, you can vote in whoever you want, but you still get the government, decided it didn't want it.
Yeah, and they have no tool that their favourite tool to use is just pure suppression.
Yeah.
Pure suppression. And it couldn't help but make me think of this recent episode of Chronicles that I did with Stelios, our resident Greek in the office. So we took the opportunity to talk about some ancient Greek tragedy and Aeschylus's Agamemnon. And so if you want to look at some of the oldest examples of... you can't shush me, Samson.
One of our producers is crawling around. Literally like, crawling around on the floor.
You'd never make a Navy SEAL.
Clear. Anyway, as we were saying, ladies and gentlemen, Agamemnon, very old tale, all about tyranny and suppression and revenge and spite. And so if you want to go and listen to a classic piece of ancient Greek tragedy, Stelios and I are talking about that on the website. So let's start talking about something a little bit more contemporary, shall we? Mm. So we have here, you might remember from back in a long time ago, this year, in fact, February, that Starmer went to the United States, sat down with the Trump administration, and just lied to their face about how we have free speech in Britain and how proud he is of our tradition of free speech.
I think because he's got free speech, he thinks everybody's got it.
Yes, yes.
And JD Vance pulled him up, quite rightly.
Yeah, he did.
And he just told a flat-out lie, didn't he?
Yeah.
Just flat-out. Brazen.
As we are seeing, computers more and more these days can lie. So Keir Starmer's fully fitting into that style, isn't he? But you have the Online Safety Act, and this is, of course, what everybody is talking about. And the Online Safety Act was originally supposed to have been brought in because it was all under the guise of protecting children online, right? We have to think of the children. Right, you can't trust parents.
Well, unless there's a migrant hotel within walking distance of a school in Epping, and then you don't need to care about.
Oh, right, yes, yes, yes. No, absolutely that. If thinking about children must go hand in hand with more government overreach and more tyranny.
Yeah.
If it eases off the government's responsibility, puts more power in the hands of parents, and just more common sense in the community, then obviously that's not an option that can be considered. Of course, it has to be said that all of the groundwork for this was, of course, laid by the Tories as well.
Another left-wing government.
Yeah, yeah. More left than Labour, actually, in many ways.
It's so manipulative, isn't it? It was like the COVID thing. It's like the ultimate argument is, are you trying to kill granddad and grandma? If you don't do what we say, you're killing the old people. It's like this: if you don't allow us more censorship, you're trying to destroy the minds of little kids.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like so manipulative.
Yeah, it is.
The thing is, like, the argument is fair enough. I haven't even got kids, and I think it's a terrible thing that little primary school kids, some piece of shit kid could have his phone and he shows them something really rotten.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That is bad. That is bad.
And to protect
kids from that is great. But to use that to extend government censorship is so low.
Yeah, yeah. And like, if it came in for porn, you know, the big the sort of headline around it was to protect kids from porn, you're going to have online age verification for pornography. But then, so why is it being used to block like footage of riots, for example? That's not
immediately.
Well,
yeah, immediately. Yeah. The same day.
There you go. Yeah. Well, exactly. As Morgoth says, it took all of 12 hours for the Online Safety Act to switch from protecting kids from porn to censoring protests outside of migrant hotels. And of course, I don't really need to tell anyone that it was the latter thing that it was actually created for in the first place.
Of course.
Yeah. Of course. So you obviously have another example here where Carl, this is as well a... So Ed Davey was just doing some middle-class virtue signalling, and Carl just said to him, sorry to interrupt your trivial middle-class virtue signal, but some savage beheaded a man in London yesterday. Do you think it might be something to at least raise in Parliament? And as you can see here, under the new legislation, that has been taken away. So you can't see that anymore. Mm. You can't see the danger that has been put on your own streets.
And it's weird that
by the government.
This is a blue tick account. So this is somebody who's monetized their X account, pays for their X account. So, you know, you can reliably assume that they're going to be over 18 because they've got bank accounts, credit cards, all the rest of it.
Exactly. So
I didn't even know that. That's interesting. I didn't even know there was a beheading yesterday. That didn't show up in any of my feeds anywhere or anything.
Mine neither.
The one right next to a bus, and the guy's filming it, and somebody's holding the guy's legs.
Oh, I couldn't comment on it. I'm not clued in on this specific case. I just wanted to use it as an example of what now is the landscape of X now that this legislation's been brought in. So you have here, again, I've just clicked on that link that it takes you to, and you get basically the new rules about how X is going to govern itself. I'll actually go into that in more depth later. But of course, Elon has said that its purpose is the suppression of the people. Obviously true. For all the problems I have with Elon, he is, of course, very firm on this particular point and has, to the best of his ability, allowed X to be a very free speech platform.
Yep.
And it's really, really irritating to see X strong-armed like this by a government that genuinely cares for us probably less than Elon does.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and he's an ocean away, and he still cares more about us.
What about if I go on Twitter through a VPN and use a non-UK server?
Mm.
Would it then be...
Well...
You then post... stuff then?
You're not the only one to have this idea, as you can see here.
Just brought up the tweets.
Just a few minutes after the Online Safety Act went into effect last night, Proton VPN signups originating in the UK surged by more than 1,400%. And as it says there, unlike previous surges, this one is sustained and is significantly higher than when France lost access to adult content. Now, obviously, I'm perhaps cynical and don't believe that all 1,400% of those are just online gooners. I suspect some of them are actually trying to obviously get around for a bit more transparency about just what's going on in the internet and what they can have access to in terms of information.
Yeah,
and
it's,
all
it's
those.
Probably
sorts
safer
of things.
To use a VPN than actually giving your ID across to a porn site. I mean, I don't know if you've ever visited porn sites, but they don't seem the most reputable of websites. And you know, I don't know how well they're going to treat my information, but they don't seem to be treating those women very well.
No, not at all. So this has obviously absolutely rocketed, and you can see here a petition that's already got about 350,000 signatures to repeal the Online Safety Act, which, spoiler alert, of course, they're not going to do.
This is something you can ignore, if you're the government, I mean.
Yes.
They'll just ignore it.
Yes. But it shows the strength of feeling.
Oh, right.
It shows
right.
the strength of feeling.
It's not worthless, absolutely.
No. And what's more, of course, we have to bear in mind that one time a day, even a few years ago, petitions like this could do very, very well. And you can have lots and lots of signatures, but there's no one in Parliament that actually feels a conviction of it and is obviously going to champion the people's concerns in the way that we have Rupert now. To actually, of course, stand there in Parliament, in the Houses of Commons, and say all these things on our behalf. Mm. But obviously, end of an era. For if you wanted to use 4chan in the UK, bad luck, guys. It's over.
Really, it's completely. You can't go on it at all.
Well, starting from July 25th, in accordance with the United Kingdom's new Online Safety Act. Will be immediately block and cease all access to all its content for visitors from the UK and British Overseas Territory. So, I mean, if anyone wants to try out those Proton VPNs and, you know, get back. I mean, I've never really used 4chan myself personally.
No, me neither.
But I realise the magnitude of it,
yeah.
of them having to obviously put out a statement like this. And of course, it's more relentless than that. It's always even more pernicious than what you might first think on the surface. As Lewis points out here, we're in a far more serious position than most realise when it comes to the Online Safety Act. The Secretary of State, Yvette Cooper, petty tyrant, can override Ofcom if she deems certain content harmful, and Ofcom has little power to push back. Bearing in mind... Leo, you tell me, how charitable Ofcom as an institution? And yeah. to think that there's someone more tyrannical, more cynical, more pernicious than Ofcom. How-
well, and also, I mean, there's other issues around Ofcom. I mean, you know, they're part of the woke blobs. They've got their own ideological bent. They're geared towards, you know, seeing certain things as harmful and other things not as harmful. This whole thing of, you know, harm, I don't want Yvette Cooper or Ofcom or some, you know, apparatchik who knows nothing about me to decide what's harmful for me. I think I've got a better idea of what's harmful to me and my family than these people who want to put a migrant hotel next to my family. I think it's ridiculous. And also Ofcom doesn't have the resources to police the entire internet fairly and effectively. So it's obviously just going to be targeted at certain people. Lotus Eaters would be, you know, something that's critical of the government would be something I'd imagine.
I would never dare.
it's taking, like, the actual Home Secretary or the Home Office just taking responsibility for all of that. If Ofcom hasn't got the ability, the resources, the time to actually police this stuff,
yeah.
how is the Home Secretary going to do it? Or even if she hands it off to a team of people in her office or something, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't really add up.
I think it might be the same sort of strategy that they used with the Southport rioters. So, you know, they dished out incredibly, like, ridiculously heavy sentences to a few people, like Lucy Connolly. Well, not a few, quite a lot of people, but Lucy Connolly, for example. So that's a big sort of headline sentence that everybody knows about. So that's, you know, to sort of intimidate anybody else who might be thinking about it into not doing it in case they get 32 months in prison. So I should imagine this will, you know, make some big headline takedowns to sort of warn other people. Oh, if you criticise the government's policy on anything or, you know, on these particular issues or, you know, go against our ideologies, then you're going to be in trouble too.
Which puts the British public in a very impossible position because there's just so much to criticise. Of the government. And the Free Speech Union actually did a very good write-up of what a lot of this entails. And I'll just go through some of it. They go on to say that at the heart of the regime is a requirement to implement highly effective age checks. If a platform cannot establish with high confidence that a user is over 18, it must restrict access to a wide category of sensitive content, even when that content is entirely lawful. This has major implications for platforms where news footage, protest clips, or political commentary appear in real time. Ofcom's guidance makes clear that simple box-ticking exercises, like declaring your age or agreeing to terms of service, will no longer suffice. Instead, platforms are expected to use tools like facial age estimation, ID scans, open banking credentials, or digital identity wallets. So more and more of your information in the government's pocket.
Why can't they do any of this on illegal migrants coming across the channel?
Well,
if we're worried about safety, why aren't they doing this? Like, we don't have any idea who's even the identities of people coming across, because they tear up their passports so they can then assume whatever identity they want and whatever age they want. I mean, this is a regime that places 25-year-old migrants from pretty barbarous cultures into primary schools with children because the migrants say that they're children.
Absolutely. No, it's everything about it is inverted. Everything about it is inverted.
Yeah, the hypocrisy, the double standard is so glaring. It's so glaring.
But it's but again, you know, the people in government, they're not smart people, are they? They have no understanding of containment. They think that they can just clamp down, but what they don't understand is that with everything they throw at us, the rage, the ire, the distrust, it all swells.
Yeah.
It all just grows more and more. The pot boils.
And eventually they have to back down and do what the public want. Like we're seeing in Epping. I mean, that hotel is eventually going to get shut down. Same with Ballymena. You know, those problematic families that were causing issues for the locals, they're not going to be able to come back into that community. But if they just listened to people before it got to that point, if they just, when people democratically express their wishes, listen to the people and do what they want before it gets to the stage of protests outside hotels and Molotov cocktails.
Oh yeah, but then that would be unkind to the migrants, wouldn't it? And that's the only constituency that the government actually cares about being compassionate towards.
But I think it would be kind to them because, I mean, Britain is such a horrifically racist, patriarchal country.
Oh, God, I wish.
I cannot countenance... I just cannot, like, it breaks my heart that these people are being forced to live in such a horribly racist place. So it'd be nice to resettle them in somewhere like Rwanda for humanitarian reasons.
Well,
them.
Yeah. We'll just put a pin in that just for a second, because we're going to come to it in a second. But the what appears to be emerging, the final concluding point from this, what appears to be emerging isn't just a two-tier internet, but something subtler and more insidious, a default off mode of speech and expression, where access to unlawful content is no longer presumed, but withheld until certain hurdles are cleared. On platforms like X, the door is currently closed before users even approach it. Elsewhere, full access depends on navigating a system of checks and classifications. Either way, the long-standing assumption that legal speech should be visible by default is being quietly dismantled.
Wow.
And this is, of course, all ties in to the fact that, as you were exactly what you were saying, Leo, when you look at Ballymena, when you look at Epping, when you look at the recent betrayal with what happened with all those Afghans coming into the country, right? All these sorts of things.
Yeah, that's a good point. How come the government, when it wants to bring in 33,000 Afghan men, some of whom are apparently jihadists and, you know...
Yeah, Taliban.
Yeah, used their corrupt contacts and family members to actually get on the list to come to Britain. So they're the absolute opposite of the people we should be helping. How come when the government wants to do something like that, it doesn't have to be open and scrutinized? It can keep everything secret. Like, how come the government's allowed secrecy, but we are not? Surely, you know, we'd be better with an open society. Somebody should set up an open society foundation.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes down.
Once again, just the double standard It's so obvious. Mm. It's right up in your face. In fact, they're sort of smushing it in your face.
Yeah.
Aren't they, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, entirely. And so, you know, in response to all of this, and especially all the protests we're now seeing outside of the asylum hotels, we've got this for a bit of news. Elite police squad to monitor anti-migrant posts.
Elite.
On social media. Yeah. As elite as someone working for the government could get.
Aren't their resources already massively overstretched?
Well, the resources take priority in being redirected here, no doubt.
There's always money for state suppression.
Yeah, always.
Is this the guy looking at a Facebook page right now?
Yeah. There's a monitor just out of shot.
Can't click that, mate, he says.
Screaming at the monitor. Yeah. Through a loudspeaker.
I knew I should have got a Blue Yeti instead of this megaphone.
So we have an elite team of police officers is to monitor social media for anti-migrant sentiment amid fears of summer riots. Detectives will be drawn from forces across the country to take part in a new investigations unit until that will flag up early signs of potential civil unrest. The division assembled by the Home Office will aim to, quote, maximise social media intelligence gathering after the police forces were criticised over their response to last year's riots. Mm. So the philosophy behind it is that by taking all of this data, they're going to find the people who will be the wrongdoers and, of course, come down hard on them before the streets can actually explode with other Southports.
Yeah.
It just so happens to be that the people that they want to go after is the people who have a problem with all of the illegal immigrants and just criminal migrants in the country, right? This is...
And interestingly, they want to clamp down on any sort of social media post that could give rise to any real-life protests outside hotels or migrant centres or whatever. And they want to, you know, clamp down on anybody trying to coordinate those protests. But the counter-protests that go in, you know, the stand-up for nonsense, all those people who go in, the far-left agitators, who go in and actually try and provoke some sort of conflict with the protesters, that's actually coordinated. That's not just allowed to be coordinated, that's encouraged and funded and assisted by the state. So they get a police escort into the area, they get funding through the unions, yep, and through, you know, various, you know, money from the government is funneled to them in various ways, and it's all extremely dodgy. Why are they, you know, they're essentially the establishment street militia.
Oh, absolutely.
Why are they allowed to coordinate their protests, but then you've got some families worried about their kids, worried about a migrant centre opening near their school, and the families are treated, you know, they're smeared as racists, and now they're going to be prosecuted under the Online Safety Act.
Oh, the oppression's never been stronger.
I've used the analogy a number of times, so I'll make it my own and do it again, of a pressure cooker. And you know the pressure cooker's going to explode at some point, so you just pile more and more weight or pressure on top of the lid to prevent it from exploding. But that will only work for so long.
Yeah.
It can't hold forever. So, for example, with this, you would have thought that the more prudent thing to do would be to address the actual issue, people's actual concerns with, let's say, in this example, migrant hotels near schools and evidence of actual sex crimes and things, to actually deal with that in some way. No. We'll just double down, triple down, quadruple down on keeping the pressure cooker in.
Yeah.
And it can't last forever. It just can't.
And I think it gets compared to communist China and, you know, the Soviet Union quite a lot. But I think in China, although they do have state censorship, people are allowed to pretty much do what they want. Economically, they're free. They can, you know, there's less restrictions on running a business. And also, nationalism is encouraged, especially the, you know, the ethnic Han majority. And there's no migrant hotels being opened near primary schools in China. They take the opposite. You know, you might think that the persecution of the Uyghur Muslims is brutal, but there's zero Islamist terror in China. There's, you know, there's no sort of multiculturalism being forced on an unwilling population.
Well, you know, the only influence that we took from China was the lockdowns.
Yeah.
You know, that's a part of the Chinese society that the British state went, yeah, a bit more of that actually here. That's what we need. But then you have saying that this will be a dedicated function at a national level for exploiting internet intelligence to help local forces manage public safety threats and risks. And by threats and risks, they of course mean you watching this, right? They mean the British public at large, the people, the mums and dads, the children. Who are scared about, as you say, just walking to school every day or just growing up in some of these multicultural hellhole cities now. It's absolutely monstrous. It's really, really monstrous. But, you know, as I pointed out, like, this is going to be all the personnel required to keep up with the amount of anti-migrant sentiment I personally post. And this is, if this is just me, right, then it's double that for you. It's absolutely ridiculous. They don't have the resources to do this.
Historically, whenever any government has tried to deny reality, has tried to, or not just government, any organisation has tried to run, fly in the face of real life, of what's happening, and when it asks you to deny the evidence of your own eyes and ears. It won't last forever. It cannot last forever.
Yeah.
They can go crazy. They can go full Mao. They can go full Stalin on it. It will not last forever.
No. Yeah, yeah.
It cannot do.
And people always find a way around as well. Like Professor David Betts raised the issue. So in the Eastern Bloc under Soviet communism, people wanted to listen to Western music, but it's banned, obviously. So they found out that they could bootleg music onto medical X-rays because I guess they're, you know, the hard plastic. So they could basically, you know, engrave it like a phonograph, like a record. So it was called bone music because it would be like literally played on this X-ray of a bone.
Right.
And so people always find a way of, you know, getting round. I mean, that today that would be, you know, a Lily Phillips being bootlegged on it.
That's cool. That's interesting. I've never heard that before. That's fascinating. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. If you look at the worst times during Mao, the worst times during the Stalinist era, people will always find a way around it. It's very, very, very difficult, almost impossible, really, to deny reality, to keep the truth, even small elements of it, from getting out. Very, very difficult. And in this age where there are VPNs, and even if they ban VPNs, there'll be a new version. Coders will get round it somehow.
Yeah.
And with everyone's got a phone, it will be very, very difficult. Yeah, they'll need teams, endless banks of people trying to and failing to completely censor the truth, reality. They can't do it. They're up against a tidal wave of truth.
Yeah.
The entire project, the entire Blairite project has, for as long as I've been alive, is just waging a war against human nature itself.
Yeah.
Right? Against the need for a sense of place, home, identity, safety.
Yeah.
All these sorts of things that, you know, human beings, that societies look for. Comfort.
It's a religion. The whole, the idea is, you know, behind it, of blank slatism. So if you bring this 24-year-old man from the Horn of Africa, he's going to be exactly the same as this man who was born and raised in Somerset. That's an absolute obvious nonsense. But,
and
you know,
the public can see that.
This is absolutely, they're exactly the same. Exactly the same. Oh, but we must celebrate the cultural differences, but they're exactly the same.
Well, you know, it's that thing. If they're so worried about anti-migrant sentiment, well, if you were to, would it not follow that if you were to simply deport the hostile migrants, you might get rid of the hostile sentiment?
Exactly, yeah. Right? And it's not as if, like, I mean, and this would probably head off what could, I mean, it looks like the country's sort of spiraling towards some horrific inter-ethnic, inter-demographic conflict, you know, like Yugoslavia, like Lebanon, like Syria, like all the places that multiculturalism has been tried. And if that could possibly be headed off or greatly lessened if, you know, the worst of the people who've illegally entered the country could at least be deported.
Yeah, but I've never seen the government make a good pivot.
No.
You know, ever, to be honest with you. Not, and certainly never for our good.
Yeah.
You know, only from their own sense of self-preservation. But fortunately, not all MPs are the same. We have one man, alone.
Good Prince Rupert.
Good Prince Rupert fighting the fight. Rupert Cromwell saying he's got a Cromwell call, yeah, sure. But he's named his dog Cromwell. I think that's fine. I've written to the Home Secretary about her reported plans to monitor anti-migrant sentiment on the internet through a dedicated elite police team. We must hold this dreadful government to account. And if I were to offer just one nugget of consolation to those listening, I would just say that All of this that is being brought in, every piece of legislation designed to oppress us, it doesn't have to last forever.
Yeah.
Right? There are many, many patriots in the United Kingdom, and Rupert is just one of many, right? One of the best of them. And, you know, this government is exhausted already, and it's only...
But they seem to be hell-bent on, you know, creating a situation from which, you know, like something will arise that will make the Nazis look tame. I mean, because we've got the amount of, I mean, it really feels that the country's at breaking point, and economically we're due a massive default in our debt, and you know, the country's economics is going to absolutely spiral. They're going to be forced through necessity, because they can't borrow any more money, to slash public spending, slash NHS, slash the police, and slash all the benefits that people have been enjoying for so long.
Yeah.
So when that happens, I mean, we saw what happened in the Weimar Republic, and the Weimar Republic, comparatively, compared to Britain, has you know, fewer social tensions than we do now. So, you know, I can't believe the government is being so short-sighted and isn't seeing the danger that it's lining the country up for. When that economic crash comes, that's going to spark, could be an absolutely horrific time to be in Britain.
I agree with what you said there. It does almost feel like it's deliberate, or has been for many years, that it's not like they're just so stupid, so blind to it. No, it feels deliberate.
But
if you wanted to create this sort of situation, you would have done everything they've done over the last 15 odd years or more.
Yeah. But I feel like it is being done almost sort of accidentally, because they're just kicking the can down, the crisis management, kicking the can down the road, trying to, you know, control. And also they're trapped in their own echo chamber, where everybody around the Labour Party still absolutely subscribes to the, you know, the sort of wokeism, critical race theory, all this sort of nonsense. So they won't see... You know, they'll be like, well, of course we should have migrant hotels next to primary schools. I mean, that's incredibly enriching and good for the schools. They won't see any danger. They won't understand that any parent could be opposed to that.
No, not at all. And obviously, you know, when you think of like the people, the women in particular, in the Labour cabinet, like Yvette Cooper, right? I imagine these are people who were very, very concerned about fictional dystopias. Right, like those in The Handmaid's Tale or something, like some nonsense like that, right?
Which ironically is based on Iran post-revolution in 1979. Right. So it's not a critique of Christian, you know, the sort of Western far right or whatever. It's a critique of Islamism. It's weird that they, you know, they're not seeing that warning from it.
Well, but the point is that, you know, at the same time, these people are more than happy to create a dystopia for us to live on, of our own. Something far worse, frankly, than anyone could have contemplated. And but I think it's showing its brittleness, to be honest with you. It lacks tact. It lacks any sense of containment. And I don't think it'll last forever.
Yeah.
So let's go to the Rumble rants. So I've got Alex Adamson says, rejoice, gentlemen, the five new Labradors. They're a small litter due to... I'm sorry, if you're saying that your dogs had a litter, then I'm very, very happy for you.
I think that's what they're saying.
Oh, right. Well, wonderful. Okay. Hasification says, always remember the Tories were the ones that made and passed the Online Safety Act. Labour only used it as a logical conclusion because they're predictable garbage. Yep, absolutely. Engage few, penny for the Kia. Yes. we've got Logan 17 Pine says, you can tell that the Dark Lord is not home. Yeah. He would have been smarter about this and would have waited at least a month. Yeah, but it looks like they're still all getting the digital ID in place, don't they? Hadification says, the Tories had every chance to prevent this. The Tories as an institution are parasites that must be destroyed. I don't care about the good Tories. Well, as I say, I'm not cared about a perfect victory. I'm cared about victory. I care about victory. So we will see what opportunities are presented to us in the coming years, I suppose.
And I think the Tories were sort of hamstrung by the fact that, you know, government can't really actually affect that much change. It sits above this blob that, you know, Truss talks about that really controls everything. And, you know, I think, you know, the idea of that, the idea of having the ballast in the bottom of the ship that stops the ship veering too far off course when you get a new government in, that makes a bit of sense. But, you know, in this case, that ballast has been, you know, that blob has been absolutely captured by, you know, far left activists. And as a result, you know, even the people in the Tories who wanted to do something good couldn't do it.
Yeah, but also the Tory party for all these years was entirely staffed by Lib Dems, who kind of just agreed with all the presuppositions of Labour anyway. It's like, you're not diverse enough. They're like, good point. You know? So O-Punk says, I'm sure censorship is going to stop the English getting mad about the government giving their kids' future and safety away. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like, well, yeah, all the policies that they implement are the real ones threatening the safety of children, isn't it, as we covered in it. We'll move on from there. Sorry, folks, just for the sake of time. We'll get back to those Rumble rants if we've got the time.
Okay, So I'm going to talk about what The Economist gets wrong about the hotel protests. So I subscribe to The Economist. I read it because it's, you know, it's widely read and respected. It sort of distills a lot of information down into quite a concise form. It's a view into our political class, and it's traditionally been quite sort of evidence-based and rooted in, you know, Western values. It's rejected fashionable ideologies when they come along, such as gender ideology. It was an early mainstream critic of gender ideology, which, I mean, you could ask the stupidest man in Wetherspoons could tell you that drugging, sterilizing, maiming children is possibly not the best thing for them. You know what I mean?
Like, well, maybe he can write for The Economist too one day.
Yeah, he might do a better job. The trouble is the sort of post-war liberal consensus that The Economist still subscribes to is starting to unravel. When we touched on it in your segment when we're talking about, blank slateism, for example, this idea that people are just interchangeable economic units and you can move, if you move the population of Somalia to Norway and the population of Norway to Somalia, Norway wouldn't be the same, and Somalia wouldn't be the same.
No.
And Somalia would probably be a highly functioning country.
Although swapping out one bunch of sea raiders for another might be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, that's a good point. They wouldn't have to change all the exhibits in the museum.
Yeah.
Just change what the boats look like. So The Economist did a big, this week they did a big, did a big segment on 1 year since the riots. It's about disorder on the streets since Southport, and it says Britain should have recovered from the disturbances by now. Instead, it has got worse. So let's see how our elites, how our political class view Southport and the hotel protests since then. So the article, I'll just read the article and, you know, we can comment on it as we go through. It is hard to recover from an enormity, and Southport, north of Liverpool, suffered too. On July 29th last year, a 17-year-old named Axel Ruda Cabana murdered three young girls and tried to kill many others. The next day, as rumours spread that the killer was a Muslim asylum seeker, a mob attacked a nearby mosque and a police van. The windows of the mosque are still covered with protective screens. And it's interesting, they talk about, you know, in this article, they talk about the sort of false information that was spread. I mean, the sort of mainstream narrative is that he wasn't a Muslim asylum seeker, but his parents came here from Rwanda in, around about the turn of the century? Very likely, although we've never been explicitly told, very likely, if not as asylum seekers under asylum, the asylum system, then certainly fleeing the genocide and the war in Rwanda. So, you know, I don't think it's misinformation to say that he is in some way. He was born in the UK shortly after that. But I think it's, you know, it's not misinformation to say he's an asylum seeker. As for the fact, is he Muslim? I mean, he's not he wasn't raised Muslim. Was he radicalized online into Islamist ideology? He had Al-Qaeda manuals, and it would fit with a pattern of ethnic minority men born in Britain radicalized online, such as Sudesh Aman. So this guy here, so you know, he was radicalized online. We've seen many instances of this, and I don't know if the alienation that somebody who isn't native to the country, you know, might feel would play into that. So people would look for an identity, look for some sort of revenge. Axel Ruda Cabana certainly spoke about finding revenge. So what were his motivations? What were his? Did he have an ideology? They're trying to get his, well, trying. The authorities are trying to get Axel Ruda Cabana's browsing history. Certainly seems to be taking a long time. You'd think that'd be maybe something that'd be moved to the top of the pile on that desk. Why is it taking so long? You know what I mean?
Well, they're too busy spying on us for anti-Ruda Cabana sentiment, aren't they?
How come they can use the Online Safety Act to get anything that we've done online, anything that we've looked at online, but they can't tell us what Axel Ruda Cabana was looking at online?
Nonsense, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Just liars. They're just lying. It's that they can't do that or haven't done it yet. It's just nonsense. I mean, and also a small point. Well, it's not a small point, but a point to make is the fact that he was born here.
Yeah.
So?
Yeah.
So what? Wasn't that Salman Abedi born here? Right. Wasn't the jihadi, the Beatles? You remember the Beatles? The four, they called them, they went out to Syria and beheaded people. They called them John and Ringo and stuff. Those. Yes. They were born here.
Mm.
Yeah. Weren't a lot of the, or all of the 7/7 and 21/7 bombers, or most of them, at least some of them, on 7/7 anyway, were born here.
Mm. If anything, it sort of blows a hole in the whole liberal idea blank slateism and anybody who comes here, you know, integrates and becomes British. Because we're seeing people born here who certainly carry the... Or seem to be influenced by the
openly haters,
the culture and history, and also was he motivated by anti-white racism, the critical race theory that's espoused by the Labour Party, you know, and espoused by the establishment. I mean, it's interesting that people with origins in other countries are, you know, the narrative is that he's a Welsh choir boy. Oh, he's so British. You know what I mean? It's like, I think that's the misinformation. Mm. Because, you know, people with origins in other countries are encouraged to celebrate their cultural differences and heritage and all that sort of stuff. But Axel Ruda Cabana is just British. Oh, he's just British. And that's it. There's no influence or any heritage or anything that he's bringing with him that comes from, you know, the genocidal nation of Rwanda.
What he was brought up like? Can you imagine? I can't really, but the conversations that must have happened or not happened around their dinner table, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, because children or even teenagers are a reflection of their upbringing. They're a reflection of their parents. Can you imagine what sort of craziness was put into his mind by his parents to do what he did?
Well, I mean, I
you can only imagine, right?
That's just sort of speculation because we like his father seems to be integrated, but it's interesting that you know, like you're saying earlier, the people who are born here, you know, that have integrated parents, the first generation migrants who come here have an urge to integrate, but then the second generation, the third generation, the fourth generation, the people that we're told are British are the ones that then have issues with identity, have issues with alienation, have issues with being radicalized online. And you know, I think there's a lot about Axel Ruda Cabana that we don't know.
They're not telling us a lot from us.
The article continues. Still, Southport has taken positive steps. The victims' families have formed community groups and have made it clear that they want no vigil on the anniversary of the murders. Public gardens in Southport's elegant, somewhat faded centre will be renovated as a tribute to the girls. The local MP speaks of stronger emotional bonds and a growing willingness to help others. But in the rest of Britain, by contrast, the wounds inflicted a year ago fester. Violence broke out in many cities and towns after the Southport riot. Some places like Belfast and London have long histories of disorder. In others, the disturbances were shocking. Protesters clashed with the police in Weymouth, a southern seaside town. One of the worst riots was in Tamworth, near Birmingham, a town that gave its name to a fine pig breed. The crowd there attacked police, smashed its way into a hotel with asylum seekers inside and tried to set it on fire. Some were more like organised assaults than protests. Few attendees carried placards, although some were draped in British or English flags. They attacked mosques and hotels containing asylum seekers. Anybody who tried to stop them became a target. In Sunderland, a taxi carrying Filipino nurses was attacked. In Burnley, Muslim graves were vandalised. I mean, obviously, it's terrible that graves are vandalized, you know, Filipino nurses are attacked, but it's almost as if the government should have listened to people when they expressed their wishes democratically. Every time there's been a vote or a proxy vote on immigration, like Brexit, like anything like this, nobody's been like, nobody's ever clicked the button saying, please, lots more Islamic migration, please, lots more people come from, you know, deeply alien medieval cultures.
It's not like we haven't, generations and generations of Brits haven't been voting for less immigration since Powell.
Yeah.
Right. Since it all started.
Yeah.
Right. That article listing off everything that was done wrong by the protesters, does it also go into any of the details of all the crimes that the pro-Muslim counter-protesters did?
Exactly. I mean, like...
Does it?
Later on, it basically refers to them as just anti-racism or anti-fascism groups, when we know they're the, you know, far-left radicals. It's absolutely mental.
Or using their mosques as sort of weapon caches.
Yeah, yeah, and being encouraged, being told by the police, oh, leave your weapons at the mosque. It's like, leave your weapons at the mosque. Excuse me?
Or beating the crap out of some random guy.
They call it the arsenal.
Yeah,
that's right.
Beating the crap out of some random white guy sitting outside a pub, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Lots of examples of things like that.
Loads of examples, and they said. Remember the 13-year-old girl who was charged over a hotel riot. So if we move on to the next one,
sure.
The next tab. So this is a 13-year-old girl charged over a hotel riot. She admitted a violent disorder charge in that she used or threatened unlawful violence that would cause a person to fear for their personal safety. So these adult male asylum seekers were terrified of this 13-year-old girl. A group of adult male asylum seekers terrified that a 13-year-old girl was going to beat them up. I mean, that's really sort of stretching the bounds of plausibility. It's almost a complete subversion of the grooming gangs. It's like, now we're going to see the grooming gangs, we're going to see the victims of the grooming gangs prosecuted because for forcing themselves on. I mean, it's an absolute nonsense. And it says most rioters seem to have been local people. Some had violent histories, blah blah blah. But the riots also drew families who had come to watch and cheer. Almost one fifth of those arrested in Stoke were under 18. Well, now they've got the vote, so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously that vote will get ignored if they vote the wrong way, to the regime. But this bit's interesting. Protests and riots do not just accomplish tangible things in the moment, such as damaging property. They also create movements, as people who hold niche or scorned views see their passions reflected in others' eyes and actions. Mr. Drury, who studies crowds, notes that Tommy Robinson, a rabble-rouser, their words, not mine, held a large rally in London 2 days before the Southport murders. Extremists may have been in a confident mood, believing their vision of a foreigner-free country was widely shared. This seems...
Oh,
I mean,
the Tommy fans that are the extremists.
Yeah, if you skimmed over that, you'd think Tommy Robinson was exploiting somehow exploited the murders before they happened.
Well, Tommy Robinson doesn't believe in a foreigner-free country.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So they've entirely mischaracterized.
That's an absolute myth. It's a myth that Tommy Robinson is a foaming-mouthed racist. He's actually supportive of immigrants. If we move on to the next tab, we can see Tommy Robinson actually... not this tab. Where's the one?
I got another, that one.
Where is it? Yeah, this one. This is basically they did a sort of a street interview with this black British guy. Mm. And, I mean, the guy doesn't completely, you know, perfectly enunciate his feelings, but he seems like a nice guy. And I think a lot of people felt that, you know, all right, he can't name certain things about Britain, British history or whatever, but he's essentially imbued with, you know, relatively British values. And Tommy Robinson sticks up for him, which, you know, I think a lot of people did. A lot of people were saying, oh, he's not British because, you know, blah, blah, blah. Tommy Robinson stuck up for him. Would a foaming-mouthed racist stick up for him? That's, you know, Tommy Robinson's supposed to be. I don't know, it seems ridiculous. So yeah, the article continues. The riots delivered a brutal version of that message to migrants. Rioting hit Stoke-on-Trent in the West Midlands on the day that ASHA, a charity, had taken many asylum seekers to the seaside. They were marooned at a motorway service station while the police worked to restore order. Godfrey Seminiga of ASHA notices that asylum seekers seldom hang around central Stoke in the early evenings these days, as they did before the riots occurred. People are still very scared, he says. I mean, did anybody ask the residents of Stoke if they wanted a bunch of asylum-seeking, you know, adult males from medieval cultures hanging around in their city centre? Like, and their 12-year-old daughters walking past these guys? Well, you know what I mean? What about the feelings of safety? We're so concerned about the feelings of safety of these adult males who've decided to jump on a boat and get here. What about the feelings of safety of British children? Why are we prioritising their safety and not prioritising British children's safety? It just blows my mind.
Well, also just something we covered on the podcast last week was that when these illegal hotels go up, they don't even have to inform the locals that they're happening. They can they'll just spring up one day and you'll be like, oh, so that's a thing now, just in the centre of my community, and right next to my school.
In fact, the Epping one, I think they deliberately didn't tell the parents because they were worried about any, you know, negative backlash or whatever. So then the parents don't even know, oh, by the way, you should start driving your kid to school. You know, you got young daughters, you should start, you know, walking them to school instead of letting them walk in what was previously a pleasant, homogenous British area. It's not anymore. It's been colonised by a regime that hates you.
Who wrote that article?
I don't know if they actually put authors in The Economist.
They're saying that the illegal invaders no longer feel comfortable loitering in the evening. It sounds like, good. Good.
Yeah, and this is they're unwittingly, you know, saying, it's like with Ballymena, the government, the regime has unwittingly said, oh, by the way, if you want to effect change, there's no point going to the authorities. There's no point complaining democratically, raising your voice in a council meeting. We'll just call you racist and throw you out. Orla Minahane, who is a resident in Epping, she raised the issue in a council meeting. She was worried about the hotel, the migrant hotel. She was thrown out of the meeting. So then what are you leaving people as an option to do, right, except for direct action? It's ridiculous. So the article continues. Britain's confidence in multiculturalism was shaken too. Hope Not Hate, an anti-fascist group. Hope Not Hate are an anti-fascist or anti-racist group in the same way that the Democratic People's Democratic Republic of North Korea is democratic. It's ridiculous.
Nick Lowell's actually spread real disinformation.
Absolutely. Yes, very dangerous, very inflammatory. Could possibly have spurred real-life violence. He said that, said that there are acid attacks against Muslim women. Mm-hmm. So the implication was that it's white British men throwing acid in British women. I mean, he's straight away a basic sense check. You know, where are the white British men who've done that? You know what I mean? That's not
our cultural thing.
Exactly. That's other cultures that do that, and I think we know which ones they are. But it's interesting. So British Future, a think tank, shows that people are more concerned about divisions between immigrants and natives than between any other groups, including the rich and poor. And attitudes to Muslims and immigrants has quickly hardened. I think they did surveys right after the Southport riots that showed that, you know, people, you know, were very dismissive of the rioters, didn't agree with the rioters, and were sort of more sympathetic towards the migrants, and that's now changed. I don't know if it's just, you know, the ongoing reality of the situation and the fact that, you know, things are really rapidly getting worse, and there are no brakes on this train, apparently. And they talk about the police vigorously pursued brick chuckers and laptop demagogues alike, arresting more than 1800 people. We were arresting people and putting them in court the next day, says Ian Drummond Smith, who investigated the riots at the National Police Chiefs Council. It helped that body worn cameras and CCTV are ubiquitous. There's no exploration here of potential subversion of the independence of the criminal justice system. There certainly seems suspicions that judges and duty solicitors were being steered by the state, being steered by the party, and they should be, you know, completely independent. Your duty solicitor, if you're arrested, your duty solicitor, that's a state-provided solicitor, should just act in your own best interests. And, you know, there seem to be a lot of people who are advised to plead guilty to relatively minor things. Lucy Connolly, you know, it's just a tweet. She got 32 months after pleading guilty. So they're advised to plead guilty in the expectation they're going to be, you know, let off with a slap in the the wrist. And instead, they're getting the maximum sentence possible. So is there any collusion going on? I mean, I'm very suspicious of that. Other people are very suspicious.
They don't even really try hide it, do they?
We've spoken to all sorts of legal eagles. Mm. Robin Tilbrook or even Stephen Wolfe. Mm. Don't plead guilty.
Yeah.
Just don't do that.
Mm. Yeah.
If they tell you, you'll get we'll let you off with a slap on the wrist if you just plead guilty now. Here, sign it. Don't do that.
Yeah, that's like...
That's a lie. That's a lie. They're lying to you.
That's like something the Turkish police or the Soviet police, the NKVD would do. Like, you know, tell you, put stuff in front of you. Oh, just sign this and we'll make it all go away. We'll stop electrocuting your testicles. It's like, don't do that. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think we're probably just, you know, a few days away from
the electrodes.
Brits putting electrodes in testicles.
Have your day in court. If they're accusing you of something, let a magistrate or a jury decide.
Look at
don't just plead guilty.
Look at Jamie Michaels. So Jamie Michaels is an army veteran who made a video after the Southport killings, and really he just made some very good points that I think most people would agree with. He didn't say anything, you know, he said everything should be peaceful, any protesting or whatever. He just made some very good points, and he was arrested on the orders, or on the, you know, after he was reported by a Labour politician. So this is, you know, the party directing the, you know, the arms of the state to do their political dirty work. So he was arrested, and he had to spend, because he pleaded not guilty, he had to spend a couple of weeks on remand. Because that was the other thing. People were told, if you plead guilty, then, you know, you'll get out of remand. You won't be held until your trial. So he spent a couple of weeks in jail, but, you know, it took 17 minutes for a jury to find him not guilty. The thing was, a lot of these cases are just complete shams, complete farces. So like you say, if you plead not guilty, you know, it's gonna all fall down in court.
That's what they say, we'll hold you on remand, you can go home today. You can go home in an hour if you just plead guilty.
And
so people go, okay, I don't want to be held on remand. Well, you just not a good idea. You'll end up doing more time in the clink.
Absolutely. And, you know, with your reputation absolutely smeared and everything. And interestingly, the anti-racist groups, it says, played a crucial role in the riots. They rallied in Stoke-on-Trent, hoping that anti-immigrant protesters would abuse them rather than attacking targets such as mosques. Bait on the hook, as one later put it. So they're inadvertently admitting that the left-wing counter-protests went to provoke violence. They were like, you know, we want them to attack us instead of the, you know, whatever it is, the police or the mosque or whatever. It's like, no, you're basically just saying you went there because you wanted a ruck, you wanted a fight.
Well, there are headlines to create, aren't they? you know, people to put in prison, you know.
There's a narrative to construct.
Exactly.
Yeah. And yeah, for all that people are called neo-Nazis, far-right racists, I mean, do these look like far-right racists to you? I mean, probably
the homemade placard.
Probably do by now.
Well, they are all guilty of being white.
Although the woman who apprehended,
greatest crime of all,
the woman who apprehended the alleged nonce in Epping was a black woman, and you know it's interesting that, you know, there are black people protesting. I saw videos of a black guy you know, smashing the window of a police van. So it's really, you know, about values rather than skin color. But yeah, they do seem pretty white here.
It's inexcusable.
2025, come on.
Yeah.
Come on, where are the obese black women?
Not on Scam.
But I mean, do these look like neo-Nazis? And like you say, homemade signs. You saw the Stand Up For Nonsense signs, all printed, all funded, all organised by, you know, various arms of the state, NGOs, well, things like that.
Especially as more and more ordinary people, just concerned citizens, come out now on the streets, the government has an even greater impetus to get the counter-protesters on the seat, on the streets, to at least give the appearance of some, oh no, there is another side that agrees with what we're doing. Look at all the placards, look at all the people. Right, obvious nonsense, totally astroturfed, and everyone can see it. But that's obviously the reasoning behind it.
And I don't think it's fooling anybody anymore. And yet the article continues, most dispiriting are the political changes over the past year. Last summer, Britons thought the Prime Minister Keir Starmer handled the riots fairly well.
Did we?
Well, I mean, no. in the polls, they did say. I mean, I think it's because he showed a bit of toughness and resolve. But really, what he should have done is come out and be like, listen, I understand you know, that Rwanda plan that we all voted against, we've decided it's a good idea. You know, like, you should have done something to just acknowledge that, you know, the British people, I really think that British people should, at the end of the day, have some say in how the country's run. And yeah, people back then, they gave lower marks to Nigel Farage, leader of Reform, who had been railing against asylum seekers for years. In a much watched video shot in 2020, he said the residents of one hotel could be terrorists and other asylum seekers had committed horrible acts in our country. When the riots broke out, he questioned whether the police were telling the truth about Mr. Rudakabana. Now, they're sort of implying there that Nigel Farage was spreading misinformation. He wasn't. The residents could well be terrorists, and it's overwhelmingly likely that some of them are. I mean, look at the next tab. Taliban fighters brought to the UK are jihadists. There's thousands of jihadists, thousands of people who are on the side of the Taliban coming in.
Think you know they can come in legally as well?
Yeah, we've had so many terrorists, like Salman Abedi, the Manchester Arena bomber. He'd gone back to Libya. He was rescued from Libya by the Royal Navy and brought back to the UK. He's like essentially a refugee from Libya. Refugees sometimes commit horrific things. If you bring people from, you know, the Horn of Africa or Afghanistan or whatever, it's very likely that a lot of them are going to at least sympathize with Islamism. Moving on. In the past week, demonstrators have gathered in Epping to protest outside a hotel which houses asylum seekers, including a man charged with sexual assault. Protesters chanted, "Send them home and save our kids." Mr. Farage warned of civil disobedience on a vast scale. On July 23rd, protesters assembled for a second night outside an empty hotel in London, following false claims that asylum seekers from Epping had been moved there. I mean,
It was just an elite, just a different set of illegal immigrants in a different hotel. Not the same.
Yeah, just coincidentally, the day after they'd been moved out of the hotel in Epping. I mean, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, asylum seekers were definitely moved there if they're from Epping or not. And they're not asylum seekers from Epping. Nobody's seeking asylum from Epping yet. You know what I mean? They're from Somalia, Ethiopia, wherever. The people have come across on boats because they want to work for Deliveroo.
Well, in fact, the people, a lot of people in Epping are, you could say, sort of fleeing themselves, right? They fled to Epping from the centre of London.
Exactly, yeah. The white flight. I mean, this is a lot of the British property market is just based on, you know, people wanting to live around other native Brits or other, you know, people who have British values.
Something that, like, everyone before 1946 was just allowed to do.
Yeah, without being called an evil racist.
Without the entire apparatus of the state.
Yeah.
And it down on you.
The article goes on to criticise Tory MPs for referring to two-tier policing and two-tier justice, which implies that white people are treated more harshly than others. But there is open two-tier justice. I mean, we can openly see it.
Yeah.
It's mental. And it's not just in the last year. Going back decades with the grooming gangs, with the establishment, you know, fearful of any uprising if they tell the truth, if people find out about it, they instead try and keep the lid on it. They're so worried about community cohesion. If community cohesion is such a concern, why are you bringing in people from far off, really alien cultures and dumping them on cohesive communities? Like, these places, Epping was already a cohesive community.
Yeah.
It's not going to be improved by, you know, dumping hotels full of migrants. And we're going to see the country balkanize and splinter, because I mean there's left-wing areas where people are like, oh my god, we need more migrants and stuff, and I think it's absolutely essential that we place the migrants in those areas, because at the moment a lot of the, you know, the Lib Dem areas, the Green Party areas are quite leafy, quite nice, well-to-do boroughs, so they're not living up against the issues that they're creating with their opinions.
Well, you see how the Boris wave impacted public opinion in that regard, because the Boris wave was so huge, so seismic, and was smuggled in whilst we were all locked in our own homes.
Yeah.
So when people came out again, they went, hang on, my area looks really different now.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden,
Now it's matching the adverts on
the NIMBY began to hate.
The two-tier policing, two-tier justice, two-tier reporting.
Mm. Yeah.
It's been going on for many a year, though. Mm. You might not remember this, you might be a bit young, but yeah, I'm sure you remember this. You remember Damilola Taylor?
Yeah.
If anyone who doesn't remember or isn't British, there was this little black African boy that was stabbed to death, tragically, in a stairwell somewhere in London.
Yeah.
And no one knew who did it for quite a few years, and they thought it was another Stephen Lawrence. Mm. They assumed it would be a white person that killed this kid. And so it was like a big deal. And then eventually, a few years later, they found out it was another black boy. There wasn't much older. And then never hear from it again. But damn a load of Taylor, he was being hammered with it. Damn a load of Taylor. And then nothing.
Yeah, because Stephen Lawrence, I mean, that and the McPherson report that came out, there's an inquiry afterwards that uncovered, you know, systemic racism in the police and all the public services and stuff. And that had such a long-term impact on policing and all the, I mean, all the stuff that was happening in Rotherham was, you know, partly because of that massive overreaction where people were so fearful of appearing racist or being called racist that they'd rather let girls be raped and killed than, you know, than suffer. It's
a sick society.
Yeah, it's sick.
It's a sickness.
Yeah,
it's diseased. It's corrupt.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason, you know, the grooming gangs, part of the reason it took Britain such a long time to sort of confront it is because we know that we failed those girls. It's not just that you know, we brought in Mirpur Valley clans that, you know, have deeply different attitudes to us and dropped us on these post-industrial towns. It's because society, because we went through this sort of neoliberal change, which is really good for a lot of people. You know, if you're a working class person with, you know, gumption, whatever, you can get out, move to London, get a good job, whatever it is. But, you know, it completely disrupted these communities and the natural protectors who would have been in Rotherham to protect these girls, you know, the families that would have stayed together, the church, the community and all that sort of stuff had all disintegrated and just left these girls at the mercy of the state and at the mercy of whoever wanted to prey on them. Mm. We know that, you know, Britain failed those girls. It wasn't just that they were preyed on.
Apologies, Leo, just for the sake of
time. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
Towards the end, but...
Yeah.
Do read all the Rumble rants, though, because otherwise people get a bit pissed off.
No, I understand that.
Take your time, because my segment is no...
Yeah, okay.
Leave it in there.
Yeah, I was going to. Thank you, Samson. Yeah, all right then. No, no, if you want to... I was just saying that...
No, I mean, that's pretty much it. I just wrap up by saying, you know, there's so many things that they miss. Like, they don't mention any overrepresentation of foreign nationals. I think this is... and also, we've got no moral obligation to take refugees. They're not fleeing persecution. They're fleeing France. I mean, all right, there's some dog shit on the pavement, but it's not that bad. You know what I mean? The waiters aren't that friendly, but you can deal with it. Genuine refugees should take refuge in, you know, the nearest, most culturally similar country. So if you're fleeing... You know, I think Ukrainians, absolutely, they're culturally very similar. I've worked with them on building sites, you know, hardworking guys. Like, yeah, like, absolutely fine with them coming here. People coming from Afghanistan, people coming from the Horn of Africa, that's a different question. I think if you're fleeing Somalia, you're going to be better off in, probably just in Somalia. go somewhere nearby that's culturally similar and then return home when it's safe.
You certainly don't need to flee France.
Yeah, no.
I mean, they use a touch too much butter and garlic in a lot of their cooking. That's about it, really.
Yeah, and it's better for the refugees as well. But it's blatantly obvious that our asylum system is just being gamed by people who want to come here and earn £1,000 a week tax-free working for Deliveroo.
Indeed.
Which I'll probably be doing soon.
All right. For $20, thank you. Scott Sci-Guy says, never forget Axel Rudicabana was in the BBC Doctor Who skit for Children's in Need. That really makes me reach for my tinfoil hat and just some cash for the unemployed funny Leo.
Thanks, man.
So, you're going to go beg on the street after this, aren't you, Leo?
I've got a Patreon.
Oh, gosh.
I do advanced cyber begging, but essentially still the Scottish tradition of alcoholic aggressive begging. But yeah, I do lots of content on my Patreon and my YouTube channel. So yeah, subscribe.
Yeah, do.
Subscribe.
Do indeed. ShiaMo20 says, I would say things that go against life is the political side, and that which promotes life is the religious side. Well, I mean, I'm not a particular religious man, but I would like to promote life, you know, these days. Seems to be a lot of nihilism out there. Logan17Pine says, in the Soviet Union, the newspaper truth had no truth, and the newspaper news had no news, which is very, very true. You've got O-Punk says, Trigonometry actually had a victim of the grooming gangs on yesterday. She got locked up for inciting sexual activity. Sounds absolutely twisted. And I'll probably check that out. Thank you. Engage Few says, guilty pleas are nothing but a fig leaf for the state. Make them be tyrants in their own damn name. Yeah, yeah. And then once again, Engage Few, it'd be hilarious if the protesters started blaring Slayer's cover of Guilty of Being White. I don't actually know that song, but I'll open Spotify after. How about that? All right, then. Bo, pitch is yours.
Okay, so I thought we'll end today's podcast with, you know, a bit of a throwaway, silly segment, a joke segment, women's football. So a couple of talking points, I think. First of all, the good things, the positive things. I'm not completely insane. I'm not actually a misogynist. Good on them, if anything. Good on them.
We're not convinced.
No, good on them. But I do have a few concerns about the lie that the actual quality or the level of skill is of any note. So, okay, first things to say, they won the tournament. So well done. Cool, good, yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Even if you don't really pay any attention, it's a small uptick in sort of national pride or whatever you want to say. Yeah, so
winning's always great, wonderful. Good.
And it also shows that British investment in sport and stuff like that is working. We seem to be doing better. When I say we, I'm talking about England, obviously, but we seem to be doing... Why don't we have a British team, by the way? Like, I know no Scottish people would get to play in it, but why don't we have a British team? At the moment, we've got a Scottish team, but it doesn't even qualify, so, you know...
Like, if there was an Olympics and there was a Team GB football squad.
Yeah. Or for the World Cup and the Euros and stuff like that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And think what it would do for national unity. Like, people with Irish accents, Scottish accents, Welsh accents and English accents.
Back in the 90s, there was always the joke that the GB team would simply be the England team, but with Ryan Giggs.
Yeah.
That's all, it would still just be the England team, essentially. As a Scotsman, you might have something to say about that. But
entirely accurate.
One good thing that came out of it, two of the lasses afterwards came out with basically like an ethnat statement saying like English blood is like the good stuff. That's the good stuff. They said something like, I'm paraphrasing.
Do you mean values?
they didn't use the word values.
I think she said, did she actually say blood?
She did. She said blood. Yeah, she said something that if you said it outside a migrant hotel through a megaphone, you would go to jail. You would go to jail, but instead, you know, Keir Starmer's all like, yeah, this other English blood, you can't. You know, although, I mean, what is English blood? Because, I mean, there's people in the team who probably can't trace their lineage back to Salisbury in the 12th century.
Right, you know what I mean? There are one or two in there,
Well,
can you imagine Ash Sharka saying, yeah, go Lionesses, wait, English blood? Wait, I'm not on board with that bit. Well, cut that bit out.
I saw a react to that. I can only assume that that lady who used the expression English blood was working, training so hard that she simply didn't realise that that's an illegal opinion these days.
Yeah, so she's not up to scratch with the new rules.
No, she needs to subscribe to the Lotus Eaters and she can get caught up.
Okay, it's all over the news. It's in the news cycle. So if you click through those few links just to show that it's in the news cycle, everyone's really excited about it. Keep going. There's sort of a live feed of watching them come home. Yeah, okay. So, the thing is, though, that we're told that it's good entertainment, that it's good football. If you remember, perhaps, that Megan Rapinoe, do you remember her? American, US lady.
Right.
Complaining why they're not paid the same as the men and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, the football's crap. I mean, here's the brutal truth, the unvarnished truth.
Yeah.
Is that it's not good football. Now,
and also it's like Rafael Nadal was asked at a conference, so he's a male tennis player, he was asked, you know, what about female tennis players getting paid less than the men? And he said, well, what about males in fashion getting paid less than the women?
Yeah, right. Yeah, the world isn't fair that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the men get paid a grotesque amount of money anyway. It's blown out of all proportion these days anyway. So, it boils down to the fact that we're expected to accept that it's good entertainment, that it's good football. Well, there's a few people like Nick Dixon, for example, and myself on Twitter every now and again will mention, like, he's shit, though. I mean, I don't want to be too out of order. I don't want to be too out of order, but it isn't good football. Right. And you get the pushback saying you haven't watched it, or you're just a misogynist, or you're an incel, or whatever it is. Yeah. I've watched thousands of hours of football.
I'd say you're not just a misogynist. You're a misogynist and lots of other things.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, loads of other things.
Historian
on top of that.
Historian yeah, of misogyny. Yeah, yeah.
Merely a misogynist, please. Please. What an insult.
The History of Misogyny by B.B. Dade.
So the thing is, I'll say, is that I've played loads and loads of football in my time. I was one of those boys that was football mad.
Yeah.
Right, from year 7 to year 11, it was nothing but football. Mm. Played loads and loads of football in my time. Played Saturday League football. Played tons of five-a-side. Watched an insane amount of football in my time. Had a season ticket at West Ham. Been to loads of away games. Been all over the country on away games. I'm not into it so much as I've gotten into my 30s and 40s, but watched tons and tons of football. I'm a referee. I'm an official FA Third Class County referee.
Nice.
When I was like 17 odd, I did the little course and sat the little exam you have to do. So I've ref loads of games as well, loads of 11 a side games and loads of 5 a side games, so I know a bit about football.
Yeah.
Okay. In fact, one of my highlights of my time at Lotus Eaters was I sat down with the living legend Mr. Matthew Letissier. Yeah. Southampton and England legend, one of the most skillful players ever to have played football, statistically one of, if not the greatest penalty taker of all time. I sat down with him. Check it out. I think it's free, actually, because it was an interview. So you don't even have to be a subscriber.
I interviewed him at GB News, funnily enough, about
a great bloke, isn't
about
it?
Vaccine stuff. But you know what annoyed me? So, like, obviously, GB News is regulated by Ofcom. So you got to, like, push back and provide balance. And then all these viewers were like, being like, why is Leo so pro-vaccine, blah, blah, blah? Why is he not? And it's like, no, by platforming Matt Letizia, I'm getting his views out there. You know what I mean? I've got to push back. And also, when you interrogate an idea, it actually strengthens that idea. But anyway, just, you know, just saying.
I only mention this not just to blow my own trumpet that I sat down with Matt Letiz, but I sat there for like an hour and 40-odd minutes and was able to hang with him comfortably talking about football.
Yeah.
Going back to the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
So I just say that to say I know a little bit about football, because if anyone's out there saying, I'm just dunking on the women and I don't know what I'm talking about. Well, I do know what I'm talking about. Okay.
And I'm dunking on the women.
And I'm dunking on the women. Yes, and. So the thing is, once you know football and you've watched enough football, honestly, like thousands of hours, it must be over my lifetime, you can sort of see the physicality. If you watch someone dribble with the ball, you watch how they control it, you watch their touch, their deftness of touch, you can see if anyone's good at football or not.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not, these women. And they're supposed to be the best, among the best teams in the world. It's the European Cup final. Spain and England are certainly among, if not the best teams. And they're not any good. It's a bit embarrassing. It's a bit of a joke for a number of reasons. Okay, so there's the strength, power and aggression thing. That's sort of okay. Women are less strong, less fast and less aggressive than men. It's fine. That's not a problem. But the skill isn't there. The vision isn't there. The movement off the ball is, to be kind, minimal. So it's not good football. Don't tell me it's good football.
Yeah.
I don't begrudge them to play it. That's fine. I don't begrudge under 13s playing football. Right, I don't begrudge the guys that are kind of crap over Hackney Marshes on a Sunday playing football, but don't tell me it's good football.
Yeah,
it's not.
You know what I really want, actually? You know how Joey Barton was getting a load of stick for saying, like, you know, female pundits were ruining the men's game? I want you to be a pundit for women's football. Like, with them on the panel.
And ruin the women's game.
I would just be sighing the whole time. That's what it's like when I watch. Because I watched the final and I watched a couple of other games. I've watched some women's games, a fair few women's games before. I used to go out with a girl who played women's football. I went and watched women's games in real life, like non-league, non-professional
ones. You're an ally. I've been out
to Leighton Orient games on a rainy Wednesday. I've been and watched Dagenham and Redbridge a load of times. The thing is, you watch it, and in a real game, say a Premier League game, right, if someone does something a bit crap, it will only happen a handful of times in the whole game, they punt it downfield to nobody.
Yeah.
Everyone sighs or boos, or most people are just like, oh, like that. Like, I'm literally like, oh. One guy accidentally passed it to the other team when he didn't mean to, or stands on the ball and falls over or something. You're like, oh, like that. That's the whole game when you're watching a women's game. That's the whole game. You're like, oh, like that. It is poor. For example, there'll be there's a throw-in, right? And in a proper game of football, you go on two or three different choices and they're running around trying to make a bit of space to give the person throwing the ball in an option.
Yeah.
They're not doing it. They're just standing there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Someone in midfield looking for someone to make a bit of space, to make a run, to make an incisive run. They're not doing it. There's minimal movement off the ball.
Yeah.
There's no vision. It's not dynamic.
Yeah.
It's not dynamic football in any way.
It's quite revealing with women's sports when they're like, trans women want to come in and play against us and that's bad. And it's like, well, like that sort of shows that men are, because I mean, it's not like Wayne Rooney, it's not like David Beckham is keeping his sarong on and saying that he's trans. You know, these aren't the elite athletes. This is just blokes. This is just women like me. You know what I mean? Or like I can get in the women's football squad, you know? Yeah. And so it sort of shows that, you know, like if just your average, you know, lumpy trans can sort of outclass
lumpy trans.
Yeah.
Like things like having a decent shot where it's like an exocet, where it's like 25 yards out and the ball's still rising as it goes in.
Yeah.
It's not there. They can't do it. Like a ping a ball 60 yards across the pitch. It doesn't happen. You don't see it. And the skill. The actual skill in good football, you'll see someone sort of dropping the shoulder, selling someone the wrong way, doing a little shimmy, doing a step over, doing a back flick, all sorts of skill. You know, when you get a great winger, a truly great winger, someone like Steve McManaman perhaps springs to mind, or Rob N or something, they sell someone the wrong way and do something dynamic,
right.
Get the game moving. There was none of it. In the game last night, I didn't see not one piece of skill done.
Right,
a sort of tricksy bit of footwork.
Yeah,
not one in the whole game.
And I bet you were looking.
I was just waiting. I'm waiting for it. Yeah. I'm waiting for it. It's not there.
But is it better in terms of like, because you know the darts, they have like women walking on, or at least they used to before feminists got it banned. They used to have like attractive women walk on with the scores and stuff like that.
Or grid girls in Formula 1.
Yeah, grid girls. So women's football sort of combines the two things. Like the grid girls are driving the cars. The walk-on girls are playing the darts.
At West Ham, they used to have like basically cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Then they got rid of them at a certain point.
Yeah.
Because, but the thing that's surprising to me is that women are capable. In other words, it's not outside the realms of physics.
Yeah.
Women in other sports are incredibly good. Talk about women's tennis.
Yeah.
In terms of skill.
Yeah.
Women's tennis is extremely good.
Yeah.
And if when you watch the Olympics, there's all sorts of disciplines
where
the women are just as good as the men, or very, very nearly.
Do you think with tennis, it's because it's a bit like a saucepan? Is that?
Yeah, I think that must be it. That must be it, yeah. So, like in, say, like even 100 metres sprinting, the women are marginally slower than the men.
Yeah.
Very marginal. Mm. So it's surprising to me why in football, or even in NBA, it's a cliche almost, to the point of cliche, isn't it, that women's basketball, they're a long way off. It's a chasm.
Yeah, I'd have thought sprinting would be a huge gap.
Yeah, you would think, but it's
not muscular.
But not so much, right?
Yeah.
It's a fraction of a second the women are slower. And as I say, in all sorts of disciplines, when you watch the Olympics, the women are almost much as good as the men.
Yeah.
And I imagine in some, it's possible they're better than men.
Yeah,
it's totally possible. But in football, for some reason, there is still a big gulf. But they try and tell you there isn't.
Yeah,
they try and say, like Megan Rapinoe, that they should get paid the same as the men. Mm. That it's as good as men's football. It's not.
Yeah,
don't try and sell me that lie. It's like when a toddler comes home from play school and they've done a painting. It's finger painting. It's not even stick men. And you say, oh, that's great. That's well done. And Nan puts it on the fridge with a magnet.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all well and good. I'd be insane to stop that. But don't try and tell me it's a Caravaggio. Right? Don't, because it's not.
Yeah.
Because it's not.
I wonder if it's something to do with like spatial awareness and stuff. Because like my wife, very intelligent, like very good at like a lot of things. But when she loads a dishwasher, I mean, you'd think it's her first time encountering three-dimensional space. It's like there's stuff sticking up, blocking the bit that spins round. There's stuff like that way up, so it collects the water. It's like, everything's just higgledy-piggledy. There's no tessellation.
Not doing it properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just with the football, I won't label the point too much, but once again, even over Hackney Marshes on a Sunday, or watching Dagenham and Redbridge play, they're better.
Yeah.
They're better. And it's just the unvarnished truth.
Yeah.
Me and half a dozen of my mates are better at football than some of those women in that European Cup final. I'm serious. So
this is that somebody's got to test that out. Hopefully they're celebrating their win by watching Lotus Eaters. And they're going to challenge you to.
I would love to play a game of Wembley singles or Wembley doubles against some of these women. And I'm like old. I'm like, I'm 43 with no cardio. But I am more skillful and more powerful than those women.
Right, yeah.
And I'm crap. I never made it anywhere near. Like, I played Sunday League football, right? I never made it anywhere near even non-league football.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, but I've got a couple of mates who also never made it anywhere near that are significantly better than me.
Mm.
And they would run rings around these women. Mm. So, the proof is in when you do get women playing men. And it's happened a number of times in recent years.
Even with, like, under-15s teams. The male under-15 team will, like, absolutely trounce.
So recently there was the Swiss, again, international team, played an under-15s side and lost like 5-0, I think, or 7-0 or something. A number of times there's the US women's team, a number of times have played some boys and got smashed like 9-0 or whatever, 15-0. One time there was a professional women's team played, I think it was the US international team that at the time was one of the best in the world or the best in the world. And they played, I think it was 7-a-side, and they played a retired team of Wrexham players. Right. So Wrexham, not the greatest club in the world, and they were retired players, guys in their 40s and 50s with beer guts. And you could tell they were playing at like 40%. They were walking around,
right,
pinging it to each other every now and again, just having a shot and it'd go in. And they won, I think they won like 7-0, 7-1, 9-0, something like that. Yeah, or they stopped the game at half time. I've seen that happen as well,
because
it's so embarrassing.
So
all right, well, we'll leave it there. But the point
well
is...
Well done, girls.
But well done.
Yeah, well done
for winning.
Well done for getting some of those far-right talking points into the mainstream.
Yeah, I was struggling for a segment this morning, so thanks. Thanks for giving me that one.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Okay, I'll just read through some of your Rumble rants, Bo. That's a random same random name. Says, I can never properly enjoy men's football because neither team is ever able to pick up momentum because they keep falling and pretending to get hurt.
It's true.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. When you look back at, you look at a game from the 70s, watch an old game with like Bobby Moore in it or something, or George Best, they're smashing each other to bits.
Oh, really?
They're trying to break his legs, and the ref's just like, yeah, play on, keep going.
Right.
Yeah, it's got a bit more pansy these days, I must admit.
Yeah.
In fact, in the women's game last night, it was ridiculous. They were giving fouls away and giving yellow cards out for nothing. For nothing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And Habsification says, the National League North and South is the sixth tier of English football and is the first level of semi-professional football. The women's level is far below even that. Yeah. Is this true?
It's true.
It's true. It's true. All right.
There was more, aren't there?
There are. Scott Saigai says, if I'm not wrong, the male U15 teams of USA, Australia and Switzerland have all beaten the women's national squads.
Yeah. Wow.
And thrashed them, though.
Yeah.
Like they barely get a tackle in, the women.
Jeez.
Brutal.
Well, they don't have a tackle, do they? Anyway, let's go to the video comments then.
Papa, Mama, my UK student visa was approved. Oh my God, it is just like India here.
You get a free flat, you get British citizenship, you get lots of money.
Oh my God. Mm.
I've seen a few of these. These AI videos, like, there's more satire happening from these AI videos than there is, like, in the entire mainstream media.
That's the other thing. We talked about Mao and Stalin earlier. People that have lived through that, or any sort of oppressive regime, sort of Tito, or there's been loads of examples of them. They can't stop satire.
Yeah.
Even at their very worst.
Yeah.
Even at the darkest days of Stalin's repression, people still took the piss.
Yeah.
And joked and said satirical things, tongue-in-cheek things.
Yeah.
You can't stop that. You cannot.
Yeah.
In response to Carl's "I hate Pedo Pascal," why doesn't Pedo Pascal do to Bella Ramsey what he does to Vanessa Kirby? Because hashtag Me Too is a movement of ugly women upset because beautiful women can move up based on their sexuality. No one cared that Harvey Weinstein was getting his quid pro quo. Even Oprah was pimping for Harvey. If you've seen the founder of hashtag Me Too, she definitely wasn't sleeping with anybody to get ahead.
Oh, brutal. Yeah.
Damn.
It's true, though. Very attractive women do waltz through life in a much easier way than everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the real...
Yeah, get over it. Yeah, that's
victims,
not fair.
The real victims are the Me Too thing. Like, it's me. If I'm what... I would love to suck Harvey Weinstein's dick to get a Hollywood career. You know what I mean? Are you joking? Tens of millions of dollars getting to be like a top actor?
Scottish victim complex.
I don't get that option. You know what I mean? Why don't I get that option? It's disgraceful.
If I found myself a beautiful woman,
yeah,
I would take advantage of nearly everyone in the world making way for me.
Yeah,
why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
And also these women who are like, oh, I had to suck Harvey Weinstein's dick to become an actress. It's like, no, you could have been a waitress. Like, you just wanted to be an actress. Right. And also anybody can be an actress because it's easy. You just, you know, you just put on a hat and pretend. Like, if you want to be a brain surgeon, nobody's sucking a dick to be a brain surgeon because that's an actual, like, thing you got to be good at.
Yeah.
I can't remember which comedian it was, but someone was saying about that with Harvey Weinstein, everything is like, you know... sexual favors to get roles and everything. It was like, if a guy did that, you know, it was like, oh, dad, you know, like, he wanted me to suck his dick, you know, for the role. It's like, well, son, how much do you want to be Batman? You know?
How much do you want it? That's what it boils down to.
So, all right, next one. Thanks.
Also, you can't mess with the artistic process, you know what I mean? Like,
time tested.
It might look bad, but Harvey Weinstein knew what he was doing.
So I imagine you guys have heard about that Sinners movie that's been all over Twitter. Yeah, it's your typical movie about how white people are vampires, they almost like everyone's blood. But there was an interesting element to it I didn't expect, which is that the white vampires actually look down their noses at the normal white people because essentially they view them as a bunch of ignorant racists. You know, the vampires actually want to integrate with the black people because they think it'll improve both their communities at the expense of the black people's souls, of course. But so essentially the vampires are progressive integration as white, which is a very interesting subtext to include in such a movie.
Well, I most likely shall never watch it, but I think it's an interesting take.
Yeah.
I once saw someone, I can't remember what it was, some film, some TV thing once about with vampires in it. And they said, why do you vampires care so much about virgin blood? Why are you so fixated on virgin blood? And they said, well, imagine someone offered you a bit of cake, and then a bit of cake that someone's just stuck their dick in. What one are you going to pick to eat? And they're like, oh, well, good point. Fair enough.
I've seen Cillian Murphy, whatever he's called. I watched Oppenheimer, or I watched half of Oppenheimer. Yeah. Man, it's so boring. I can't
really?
It's so boring. And also, like, it's so, there's so many sort of liberal assumptions. Like, it shows all the, like, basically the start of the long march through the institutions with all these communists having their parties. Mm. It's not presented this malignant thing that's going to lead to, you know, what we've got in America and what we've got in the West now. It's almost presented as if these, you know, these are the good guys, and the bad thing was the McCarthyist witch hunts. Mm. Man, McCarthy was like, McCarthy, we should be building statues to McCarthy.
Yeah.
He was the one thing trying to stop, you know, communism overtaking the West.
You wrote an article about that, didn't you?
I wrote an article. It was among the first ones I wrote. McCarthy did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
No, the State Department, if nothing else, was riddled with card-carrying Stalinists.
Yeah.
And I watched Oppenheimer. I really liked it, but only because I happened to be fascinated by the story of the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
But the point you make is absolutely true. All these commie parties. Mm. It's like, no, that's a malignant cancer inside the defense structure and they made it out like there's nothing wrong with it.
Is it more about the bomb?
It's a good thing, if anything.
Is it more about the bomb and the actual Manhattan Project in the second half? I'll watch.
The first half is slow. Absolutely, that's true. The first half is a bit slow about his relationships and stuff. Yeah, I don't care.
I don't care about that. Yeah.
I want to see the army and bombs going off in the New Mexico desert.
Yeah, yeah.
It does get better. Yeah, it does pick up.
Right, cool.
It does pick up.
Cool.
Well, Leo, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been wonderful to have you on the panel. Obviously, people should go and subscribe to your YouTube channel.
Yeah, you should.
For just £2 a month, you can help feed
this
poor starving Scottish Scotsman. Soul.
Yeah, otherwise I'll have to come to England on a small boat.
Could you take a dinghy round to, like, Carlisle or something and say, well, I'm claiming asylum?
Oh, all right then. Well, we'll just do. I do apologise, ladies and gentlemen, by the way, today for my clumsiness with the comments. It's just my shoddy timekeeping. From my segment, you've got Richard Minikindam says, proof no one actually reads the legislation. Slack fake headlines to push them through Parliament. It was never about children, always about authoritarianism and censorship. You can't even find the real news anymore. Yeah, this was something that I found when I was going through the search engine today, just how much of those headlines were about children, burying the actual darker details of it.
Yeah.
Kevin Fox says, the age verification systems are pointless. You can choose to scan your driving license or passport. Okay, how do they know it's your driving license or passport and not your mum or dad's? Or one you stole off a pedestrian as you rode past on your e-bike? It's a good point.
Perfectly good point.
And that Texas gal says, Online Safety Act sounds a lot like the Patriot Act for the modern era.
Yeah,
I can see the comparisons there. From your segment, Leo, Sophie Lib says, why are these people protesting? Should we ask them? No. Let's only ask high-class university graduates who've never been anywhere near the place.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And you've got Fizz Keeper Orland says, rather than the pressure cooker, I shall use the term oppression cooker.
Nice.
Yeah. And then from your segment, Bo, you've got Palest Son of Yakub, who says people will care about women's association football when they can beat 15-year-old boys.
Yeah. It's a harsh truth. When I was a kid growing up, though, we were extremely harsh with each other about who and who wasn't good at football.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Extremely harsh. I was a kid who was, like, quite good, but he had a blunder, and everyone calls him shit for, like, a year. Right? We all knew who was really good at football and who wasn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a real them and us sort of a thing.
Yeah.
And so you never sugarcoated if anyone was good at football or not.
Yeah.
That's how I was raised.
Yeah.
That's what I've anyway.
When facts took precedence over feelings.
I'd like to return to that time, you know. Zesty King says, the best thing about women's football, apart from the fail compilations, is that they can be unapologetically English. Instead of recruiting foreign men and calling them English like men's football, nearly all the women on the women's team are actually English.
Nearly all of them.
Right.
But not all of them, but nearly all of them. Mm. Yeah.
And then Jethro Evans says, I was going to comment about women's football, but I realised I don't care.
I wonder if that segment will get really good views because it's sort of in the news cycle, in the zeitgeist, or whether it will get no views really because people are like, I honestly don't care. Pass. We'll see. We'll see how it does.
All right, then. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you to Leo again. And we'll see you at 1 p.m. tomorrow. Ta-ta and farewell.
Bye.